Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to Luke's English Podcast. How are you doing today? I hope you're doing fine. I just had a haircut. I know you're fascinated to know this. I just had a haircut, and so I'm feeling all sort of fresh and new with my hair at a reasonable length again. It always makes me feel a bit better after I've had my hair cut and just feel a bit more presentable or something. And also I can now feel the air on the very back of my neck, which is quite a nice feeling. Okay, but also I'm feeling good because, as you know, I live in France, right? And so obviously when I go and get a haircut, I have to do that in French. I have to get my haircut in French, which means that, you know, I have to have conversation with the hairdresser, with the guy who cuts my hair. I have to talk to him in French. And this does kind of relate to the topic of this episode, by the way, which is a conversation with Steve Kaufman today. He's not my hairdresser. No, Steve Kaufman is my guest in the episode today. And Steve is a polyglot. He speaks lots and lots of different languages, and that's kind of what he does. He learns languages, and he learns them well. Okay, but anyway, back to my hairdresser appointment from this afternoon. So, yes, I have to make conversation in French during my haircut, right? While I'm having my haircut, I have to chat away to the hairdresser. Now, it takes me about 30 minutes to get my hair cut. It's not very long, but still, that's enough time. And if you are a long-term listener to this podcast, you'll know how I feel about getting my hair cut. First of all, I find it a bit awkward and uncomfortable. And secondly, I have to speak French. And so it's like an awkward situation made even more awkward by the fact that I suddenly feel like I can't escape. You know, I just have to speak French. And sometimes that can be, I don't know, a little bit embarrassing. This is complicated. Obviously, this is my own personal struggle. But you know what it's like when you're trying to speak another language. Sometimes you just feel a bit shy. So that's kind of the way it is for me in French. But today, I'm actually quite pleased with myself because I managed to maintain the conversation for about 30 minutes without feeling completely ashamed or without feeling completely ridiculous. Okay, I managed to have a pretty good conversation about a few different things with my hairdresser. Now, it helps that he's a nice, understanding person, and he kind of understands me, and he knows me, and he makes an effort, and he's sympathetic and stuff like that. That obviously helps, because when you're having a conversation with someone who is judgmental or not very patient or who doesn't care about you, that is a horrible situation because you feel stupid and they don't really make an effort to be patient and to listen to you. But my hairdresser is not bad, and he is, you know, he's a nice guy. So anyway, I feel good. I feel like I've made an improvement. I feel like my French is slowly improving. This is another story for another time about me and my French. And I have done episodes in the past about this subject, exclusively about this. But anyway, I'm feeling quite good today because I feel like I actually managed to have a pretty good conversation. I still feel like I'm at a kind of a B1 level, honestly. And you might be thinking, but Luke, you live in France. What are you doing? Yeah, I mean, I've many, many excuses. Of course, we shouldn't make excuses. We have to kind of actually do things to improve our language learning, not just make excuses. But my excuses are, you know, that I work in English. I do this podcast in English. I speak at home to my wife in English. And so there's not a lot of French in my life, except for those moments when I am out and about, or moments when we have a dinner party or something and I'm sitting at a table and everyone's speaking French and then the pressure is on. And that's a difficult situation to improve another language in, when you're surrounded by people and you feel very nervous and you've got, you know, you're the odd one out because everyone knows what's going on. And you're, you know, it's like you're trying to watch a tennis match, you know, your head is going this way, left, right. And eventually you don't realize where the ball is anymore. So stress and pressure, it's not very good for language learning. But anyway, I'm feeling quite good today because I did all right. And that's good. That's a way of sort of putting me into a more virtuous cycle of motivation and success, which hopefully will feed itself. I've been reading more graphic novels in French. I've found that this is a thing that really works for me. Graphic novels, you know, not comic books. That's the term we use to describe the things that children read. You know, there are pictures with speech bubbles. Okay, there's your comic books and stuff, you know, like Spider-Man and stuff. But graphic novels are the same thing, but for grown-ups. So I like to read graphic novels in French. I find that works for me. So anyway, there you go. I just felt like saying that. Now, let me stop waffling and rambling here and get into the conversation that you're going to hear today. So as I said before, this is a conversation with Steve Kaufman. He is a Canadian polyglot. A polyglot is someone who speaks lots of languages. On Wikipedia, it says that Steve speaks 20 languages. 20, yes. Now, that's one of the first questions I ask him in this conversation is actually, how many languages do you speak? And he actually kind of clarifies. But he has learned to some degree about 20 languages. These days, he doesn't actively use all of those languages. But anyway, Steve is a very famous polyglot. He's been interviewed lots of times on lots of different channels and shows. He's been featured, you know, on the news in various countries. He's written articles for Huffington Post in the United States and in Canada. He's very well known. And it's about time I interviewed him on this podcast, right? So finally, here it is. Now, I'm going to ask Steve questions that he has been asked before, but I'm saying that because I'm sure that many of you listening to this haven't heard all those interviews with him that he's previously done. So the main aim here for me in this episode was to find out from Steve how he does it. How does he learn these languages? What are the insights that we can gain about language learning? Okay, and the idea is that I'm trying to encourage you listening to this to maybe improve your habits or improve your attitude, or maybe not improve it, just feel reassured if you're doing a lot of the right things according to Steve's method. And just to consider what Steve does. He's a successful language learner. Is he exceptional? Is there something special about him? Is he unique? Or does he just do things that if we all did would gain the same results? Like, for example, if I spent my time in the same way that Steve does, if I spent my time working on my French in the same way that Steve works on his languages, I would probably see the same results. So, you know, it's about attitude, it's about habits, it's about time, it's about motivation, all the things that I have talked about before. Anyway, what insights can we gain from Steve Kaufman about learning languages? So we talk about that sort of thing. And then in the second half of the conversation, I asked him some other things about his career and about his experiences, because he's had an interesting life, interesting career, working as a diplomat, a Canadian diplomat, and also working as a businessman in Japan and in other places. So it's all language learning stuff in the first half, and then just chatting to Steve about his life in the second half. Actually, before we go any further, I feel like I need to give you some basic Kaufman facts, Steve Kaufman facts, just to help contextualize things. So Steve is from Canada, so you're going to hear Canadian English being spoken here today. What else? He was born in 1945, so he is in his 70s. All right, so that's another thing to consider. It's interesting that someone in their 70s is learning languages so actively and so successfully. And also worth noting that a lot of Steve's language learning has happened later in life, in his 60s and in his 70s. Like, fair enough, as you'll hear, he learnt things like French, Spanish, Mandarin Chinese, Japanese, in his 20s, 30s, and 40s. But he has continued to learn languages successfully through middle age and into his 60s and 70s. That's an interesting thing. Also, Steve set up and runs a language learning website called Link, which you might have come across. That's L-I-N-G-Q, pronounced Link. So when he mentions Link, he's talking about his language learning website, which you can find on the internet. So there you go. That's probably all I need to say. Canadian man in his 70s continues to learn languages successfully, as he has done throughout his life. So here is what I hope is an interesting and insightful conversation with Steve Kaufman. And here we go. Hello, Steve. Nice to talk to you.
Luke, nice to talk to you.
How are you today?
I am fine. I'm absolutely fine.
It's the morning for you. It's the evening for me. You're in Vancouver. How is Vancouver?
Well, I don't know how Vancouver is, because in the winter, the rainy season in Vancouver, my wife and I come down to Palm Springs here in California, where it's sunny every day. So here it's sunny. I imagine in Vancouver it's raining.
Yeah. Right. You don't need to worry about
that. It doesn't rain every day, but it rains a lot. No,
okay.
I don't care.
Wow. Palm Springs, how nice. So it's great to be able to speak to you. You've been interviewed lots of times before about language learning.
Yes.
And I was wondering how I could possibly ask you something that you haven't been asked before. And I think I probably can't.
Oh, all right.
So we might go over some of the same ground that you've covered in previous interviews, but we will see.
Mm-hmm. That's okay.
So first of all, let's just sort of like cover the basics, I suppose. So you're known as a language learner, one of the most famous in the world, I would say.
Wow. I don't know. That's amazing, but whatever. Yeah.
But so how many languages do you speak?
Well, you know, when you say speak, I have spoken 20, let's say. I have interviews on my YouTube channel where I have spoken 20 languages. But I would say that perhaps a dozen I could easily speak, and another eight I would struggle, either because I'm in the process of learning them, say Persian and Arabic, or because I developed them to a certain level, went to the country, spoke it while I was there, and now I would have trouble. I would have to refresh it. So, sort of, yeah. And of the 12 that I speak, you know, I would say maybe half a dozen I speak quite well, and then less well as you proceed down the list.
So half a dozen that you speak quite well, you say. How did you define quite well?
Well, in other words, I can have a comfortable conversation. I'll make mistakes. I'll be missing a few words. I will understand just about everything that's said. But I'm sort of more comfortable in some than in others. I can express myself more accurately, you know, in some, whereas in some of the weaker ones, I'm looking for the words that I really know I know and try to build what I have to say around those words. Whereas in the languages that I speak really well, I can just say whatever I want.
You can say whatever you want in those languages you speak really well. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, most of my listeners are probably trying to learn one second language. Probably there'll be others who have got several, but most of them are just trying to deal with English and trying to learn it really well. So why for you, Steve, why so many? Why so many languages?
You know, it's just circumstance. I didn't set out to learn a lot of languages. The first language that I sort of learned to a sort of level of fluency was French, because I got very motivated. I had a teacher who made French civilization very interesting to me. I ended up going off to France. I took my university training in France. Then the second language that I learned was Chinese, because I was working for the Canadian government and they wanted to train people in Mandarin Chinese back in 1968. So I was sent to Hong Kong, where I learned Chinese. Then we were transferred to Japan, so I learned Japanese. You know, when I was traveling, when I was a student in France, I used to hitchhike around Spain, so I learned Spanish. And then once you realize that you can learn languages and you think you know how to learn them, It's fun. Right now, I'm discovering so much about Iran and the Arabic world just by learning those languages. And every language that I have learned, you know, I learned so much about the country and the history, and it triggers an interest in those countries. And so all of a sudden, you know, the world, different parts of the world, you know, come alive. Areas where you had nothing but sort of vague stereotypes, those places come alive. So it's just interesting for me.
Yeah. You kind of put it in a nutshell. You know, you went to work in Hong Kong and you learned Chinese, you learned Mandarin Chinese. How?
Well, when I was in Hong Kong, and bear in mind that in 1968, you had the Cultural Revolution in China. And the objective, Canada was going to recognize the People's Republic of China, so they felt it probably wasn't politically appropriate to send me to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So I went to Hong Kong, which is not a Mandarin-speaking place. However, I had 3 hours a day, one-on-one, with Mandarin-speaking teachers, and I spent the rest of the day reading and listening. I read enormous amounts of Chinese, and that kind of, you know, established in my mind the idea that to learn a language, you need to listen and read a lot, like a lot. I'm talking millions of words. So that the brain gets used to the language. And you start to discover the patterns of the language. They can be explained to you. You may or may not understand or even remember the explanations. But more than anything else, you just have to get the language, you know, flowing into your brain so that the brain will gradually start to get used to the language.
How long did that take then to go from absolutely nothing? Well, that's quite intensive, isn't it? What you were doing there, with Chinese, that you know, 3 hours of one to one, and then lots of time reading and listening. That is very intensive.
It was the most intensively I've ever studied a language. Not only did I have 3 hours one on one, but I must have studied 7 hours a day. Like I'd go home, I'd practice writing because you have to write, you have to learn the characters. And I would listen to my open reel tape recorder, or I would read, and I would go down to the bookstores in Hong Kong and look for readers, you know, where you have Chinese with glossaries for every chapter. And it was very, very intensive. Like I was obsessed. And it took me from zero to where I remember I read my first novel after about 7 or 8 months. And I had to write the British Foreign Service exam. And I think I did that after 11 or 12 months. But we had to translate newspaper editorials from English into Chinese, from Chinese into English, you know, writing out by hand kind of thing. Mm. So it was a very intensive 1 year.
Yeah. And how was that year? Were there not moments in that year where you felt kind of demoralized, demotivated, where you felt like this isn't working? How, you know, did you hit a wall or something?
Never. I have hit walls now because I'm not doing it quite as intensively, right? So there are days when I say, holy cow, I've been at Persian and Arabic for over 3 years and I still can't speak the language. And so I'm very much aware of the sort of plateau where you're not progressing. But in the case of my Chinese, it absolutely fascinated me because what I was reading, I was getting, you know, short stories, Chinese literature from the 1920s and the 1930s. Learning the whole of, you know, Chinese as a language, culture, civilization, everything about it was so totally new and different that I was just obsessed. I just kept reading and learning and never had that sense of hitting a wall. In fact, because I was progressing so quickly, and holy cow, here I am 6 months into the thing and I'm reading all this stuff and understanding it. One of my conclusions at that time was, if you are able to do it very intensively, the way I did it, you will learn, you know, geometrically faster, because you're just bombarding your brain with the language. And all the other sort of other diplomatic students in Hong Kong, there were Japanese, there were Europeans, they learned more slowly than I did, and they learned less well. And I just was totally into it. And so within a year, I did better than they did after 2 years. So intensity is good. If you have, I'm not sure I could do that again, but besides, I was working for the government. They paid me my salary. I had a job, learned Chinese. Mm. So whereas now, if I can get in an hour a day, an hour and a half a day, every second day, that's all I do. So the intensity isn't there, but intensity really pays dividends.
What about when it came time to, I mean, you were speaking with your one-to-one teacher, but when mm-hmm. it came time to actually start using Chinese in diplomatic situations, how did you feel?
So the first opportunity would have been, they had this sort of Canton trade fair twice a year. And so even as a student, after 6 months or so, the Canadian government sent me up there. And so I was sitting in, I can't remember exactly how many months it was, but I would sit up there and the job was to help Canadian businessmen who were in Guangzhou, you know, in their business dealings with the Chinese. Hmm. So I would sit in meetings and I would struggle at first to translate, and you struggle and eventually it gets better. You know, that's all. And I mean, even in Hong Kong, our teachers who were from Beijing, they would every so often have dinners at their place, or we would go to lunch, you know, and so we'd be speaking some in a more sort of informal environment. But even in our one-to-one sessions, we very quickly abandoned any formal instruction, and we were talking most of the time, one-on-one.
Right, okay. You never felt sort of, you never had one of those days where you kind of things didn't sort of come out right, or you made misunderstandings, you may have felt like you made a fool of yourself. Did you ever feel like terribly bad at the end of the day?
Never felt like a fool, no. But, you know, one of the things they would do is they would drill you. They had these expansion drills, like, I am a man. I am a man from Canada. I am a man from Canada studying Chinese. So they'd have these expansion drills, and there were days when you say, geez, do I have to do this again? You know, so some days, you know, first thing in the morning, some days you're not as awake as on other days.
Yeah.
But never any sense of, gee, I said something wrong. You're going to say something wrong. I'm going to get my tones wrong and all this stuff. It doesn't matter. Didn't matter. One interesting thing, I feel that my Chinese is better now than when I graduated or when I finished my program there. And part of it is I've done a lot of listening to Chinese, you know, audiobooks or, you know, Xiangsheng CDs or whatever. But the language continues to gestate. So one of the interesting things that I've noticed in many languages is even if you're not spending time with the language, the fact that you have put so much effort into the language, it's now kind of fermenting in your brain. And so actually, I would say that I speak all of my languages better now than ever, just because they've had, maybe because I've learned other languages and the brain just becomes more and more flexible. A lot of stuff that you have learned and forgotten is still somewhere in your memory reserve. So the question is, are you able to retrieve it or not? And I think my ability to retrieve it improves. I think for sure my pronunciation in Chinese has improved since the time I was studying it intensively.
Hmm.
So if you put a lot of intensive work into learning a language, it will continue to gestate in your brain.
Yeah.
To bake.
Yeah, to age. I mean, it's like languages mm-hmm. are like wine then, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or cheese,
yeah.
I'm not sure.
Although past a certain point, you yeah. gotta watch it.
After a certain point, cheese. It's a bit too much, yeah. But yeah, with certain kinds yeah. of good, if it's a good wine, you can leave it for
wine,
a long time.
Wine's a better one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
But, I mean, again, you've probably been asked this before. Do you think that you are a special case, or do you think that, you know, the experience that you've had is universal?
I think the big thing is motivation and time. I often quote this professor at the University of San Diego who said there's only three things that matter in language learning. The attitude of the student, the time you spend with the language, not reading an English grammar book about Chinese, but with the language, and then your ability to notice what's happening in the language. And I think anyone who is motivated and spends the time will develop the ability to notice. And circumstances favored me, but different language environments. But I remember I was at one of these language, you know, polyglot conferences in Montreal, and I was speaking to a group of about 500 polyglots, people who, you know, came to this thing. And we would have, go to a bar or cafe in Montreal, and everyone would have the flags of the languages that they spoke. And there were lots of people there who spoke 7 or 8 or 9 or more languages. But I remember asking this group, I said, how many of you were brought up in a multilingual family, you know, looking for things that maybe made this group different. Mm. And hardly anyone put their hand up. So these were people who were motivated to learn languages. And there's no question that once you learn one and then another, And once you sort of recognize that it's not such an extraordinary thing to do, and you have the confidence that you can do it, and you put the time in, and you enjoy the process, if all of those things are there, you're going to learn. If you don't resist the language, a lot of people, when they're older especially, they don't want to change. They don't want to, you know, take the risk of trying to pronounce the language the way it's supposed to be pronounced. They kind of hang back and kind of their own, you know, native language or other languages that they know. So there's a lot of attitudinal things there, but fundamentally, I think everyone can learn. Some may learn better than others, but everyone can learn.
What do you think it is that stops people?
Well, they're not confident that they can do it. So if you're going to climb a mountain and you don't think you can reach the top, you probably won't reach the top. You know, if you look at countries like Sweden, where everyone is exposed to programs in English, say, in American or British TV programs, and so by the time they start school, they've heard so much English that they all speak well. I mean, some differences, but they all more or less speak well. So I think it's exposure to the, it's attitude, time with the language, and with that comes this ability to notice what's happening in the language. So noticing that, in fact, they don't pronounce it this other way, which is based on how that would be pronounced in your language, actually it's pronounced this way. You know, a lot of people, people learning English, for example, they will pronounce English words based on how that word would be pronounced if it were written in their own language. Mm-hmm. So you have to overcome that. You have to start noticing that, no, in English, English has a very messed up writing system. And you actually have to learn how to pronounce each word. You can't just rely on how it's written, but you have to notice that.
Absolutely. So you talk a lot about input and listening a lot and reading a lot. Is there no place for you for the sort of deliberate practice in language learning? For example, you know, doing some controlled practice with certain grammar points or, you know, controlled pronunciation practice. How does that kind of deliberate practice fit into learning a language for you?
I think it can help. It depends how much time you have available. Mm-hmm. So if, in my case, I had 6-7 hours a day to spend on learning Chinese. So I am sure that we practiced specific points of grammar in our, you know, one-on-one situations there. I think, though, people are a little bit, it's very difficult. You can practice, like I've often, you know, talked about the third person singular of the present tense in English, which mm-hmm. takes an S. And you can practice that all you want. Until that slots in as a natural thing to do, people are going to continue to, you know, when speaking on the fly, they're going to not have the S there. And at some point it clicks in. So I think a lot of these points of grammar, with enough exposure and with enough practice too, I mean, I'm not against output. I think it's eventually to speak well, you have to speak a lot. You have to speak a lot. It's just that I don't think you need to speak a lot at the beginning when you have few words, when you don't understand. When you have enough of the language that you can understand, that you can have meaningful conversations with people, then you should have lots of conversations. If you have a lot of time, sure, do drills, whatever. When I'm only spending an hour or two a day, I prefer to spend my time on input because it's easier to organize. I don't have to set up a time to be with the tutor online to do sort of specific drills. In the language that I have learned since Chinese, I've never found the specific drilling of particular grammar points all that helpful, because by the next day I've forgotten it. It's, you know, it just will click in at some point. And yeah.
So when does speaking...
But everyone's different.
Yeah, everyone's different. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. When does actually speaking come in for you? So if we start with learning a language from scratch... Mm-hmm. You start reading. Okay, let's do that. Let's start with learning a language from scratch to I can have a conversation in this language.
Okay.
What's your very first step? So you've been doing Arabic and Persian recently. So tell us a little mm-hmm. bit about, mm-hmm. let's say, Persian. How did you start?
Yeah, so obviously with both Arabic and Persian, you have a big issue, which is the writing system. It goes from right to left. The symbols are completely foreign. The individual letters, they change depending on whether they're at the beginning, the middle, or the end of a word. So that's a major obstacle. So when you start out, when I listen, it's just noise. I don't get anything. It's just absolute noise. The writing system is just a bunch of squigglies. Zero So what I do is we have at Link, we have these mini stories where the same story more or less repeats five times. Different person, different tense, you know, a negative or question, but more or less the same stuff is happening five times. So, and we have 60 of them. So I do the first lesson. I listen to it. I understand zero. Then I go sentence by sentence looking up the words. And in the case of Arabic and Persian, I have had to put separate effort into trying to get a toehold on the writing system. And slowly, slowly, by dint of, you know, occasionally reviewing what the symbols mean, then again looking up words, then listening to that sentence, and then maybe listening to the next sentence. And then I gradually progress. So I understand 30% of lesson one, I move to lesson two, and I understand 30%, I move to lesson three, but then I go back to lesson one. And over the first 3 months or so, I will listen to those stories. It adds up to about 30 times or so, like many, many times. Looking up words, reading it again, listening again. So I'm at an early stage when I'm discovering the language, so my tolerance for uninteresting content is quite high because I'm quite interested in trying to discover the language. And so that'll go on for like 3, 4, 5 months. And then I start moving to more kind of meaningful content. It might be something on history, or it might be, you know, in the case of Persian, I had this collaborator in Iran create 26 episodes on the history of Iran, followed by these, again, these certain questions. So there's now more interesting is the history of Iran. But it's the same process. Listening, reading, looking up words, listening again, reading again, still not understanding. And I just keep doing that. And when I reach about five, we count the number of words you know at Link. So when I reach about 5,000 known words, then I'm kind of motivated to start talking. First of all, I now have phrases that have been bouncing around in my brain. Plus, I can understand some. So there's no point in having an online, you know, chat or, you know, lesson with someone when you can't understand what they're saying. You can't keep on saying, I beg your pardon. Mm-hmm. So, but at that point, we can have a limited conversation. We may, for example, what I did with Persian, because we have these mini stories, which include questions. So then I would read, which is very helpful because I was trying to learn to read this Arabic script, right?
Yeah.
So I would read it wrong. She would correct me. I read it wrong, correct me. And then having read a little section, then she would ask me questions. The questions would, in fact, be the very questions that were in the text. So I knew the answer, so I could answer. So that got us into it. And then pretty soon, within a couple of weeks, I'm no longer interested in doing that. So then I stray into other subjects, and we talk about a variety of other things, and gradually the range of things that we talk about, and pretty soon we're talking about the history of Iran.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing, yeah. But your level of motivation is incredible, and also your tolerance for, you know, not understanding what you're reading is impressive too. Because I think that's a reason why people won't follow that technique, because they're just, you know, the tolerance for sort of failure is pretty low.
Exactly. You know, I say you have to have a high tolerance for, you know, fuzziness, not understanding, making mistakes, all of those things. That's absolutely key. Tolerance for forgetting. You're going to forget. And in fact, forgetting is good. You forget, you relearn, you forget, you relearn. It's in there somewhere in your memory reserve. Eventually, you'll be able to retrieve it. Just accept the fact that you are putting stuff into your brain. And just keep going. So that all of that doesn't bother me. I know I am moving forward. I know that, in other words, the key measurement in language learning to me is not what's achieved, how well you pronounce, how well, you know, how accurately you speak. The key measurement should be your activity level. If you are active, spending time with the language, you will get better. So the only thing you need to worry about is, you know, my actions. How active am I? Am I listening? Am I reading? Am I speaking? Am I doing things? If you are, you're getting better.
Mm. This is very reassuring to hear this, Steve, because these are sort of things that I've come to myself. I mean, I'm not really a language learner. I mean, I sort of try and speak French in my daily life. Let's not talk about that because, you know, it's, I mean, when I'm talking to you and there's me like struggling to speak French. But as an English teacher, which is, you know, what I've spent most of my life doing and working on and desperately trying to help people to improve their English, and doing this podcast for 14 years now as well,
right.
Just like banging on about all this stuff over and over and over again. I have said many of these things too. It's about time and motivation and practice, and you know, that's mm-hmm. the equation. And it's like climbing a mountain. You know, you don't mm-hmm. look at the whole thing like you have to do it in one go. You do it step by step and just sort of try and enjoy it. Motivation, mm-hmm. you know. We've talked about all these things before, so this is very encouraging stuff. It's just that people just actually have to do it. And also enjoy those moments of progress, those moments when you do anything, mm-hmm. when you manage to succeed
absolutely.
In any way. You kind of enjoy those things.
Right.
If you were one of my listeners, right, let's say mm-hmm. you were, you know, someone trying to get over the intermediate plateau, what would you do if you were that person?
Well, I would say find things. First of all, every opportunity you have to speak, obviously, without worrying about how you do, how you sound, mistakes you make. Anytime you have an opportunity to speak, go for it, when you're with people and so forth. But there are many things you can do even when you're not with, you know, people where you can speak the language. So, as you know, I believe in listening and reading. I think audiobooks together with ebooks are tremendous. Because I believe that if I hear a non-native speaker of English speak English, the person who impresses me the most is the person who uses the language well, who has, you know, a good vocabulary, whose choice of words... the order in which the words, you know, are put together. That's the person that impresses me the most. Not necessarily the person who is trying desperately to have an American accent or a British accent, but who can't use the language very well. So the focus is on building up vocabulary, building up, you know, natural phrasing. And I think if you listen to any kind of audio book, whether it be literature or self-help books or, you know, maybe books on your area of, you know, marketing, if you're in marketing or whatever. Mm-hmm. And especially if you can access then the transcript, because when we listen, there's lots that we don't understand. And then I always like to have a transcript. So then I can go in there, and if I use link, I save words and phrases, because I want to mine this material for phrases and structures and even in terms of introductory phrasing or how I want to be able to structure my language when I use the language. So I think there's a lot that can be done just through listening and reading in an intelligent way. And then when you do have a chance to speak, just go for it. Don't worry about how you sound. And in a way, you have to sort of project yourself as... So if I'm speaking French, Japanese, Chinese, whatever, I just see myself as a... I'm a speaker of French. I'm a speaker of Chinese. I'm not sort of this timid... non-native speaker attempting to speak the language. I just am a speaker of the language. Mm. So you've got to have that kind of a positive, you know, self-image, but also, you know, build up your weapons, build up your vocabulary, your phrasing, your comprehension. Comprehension is big. If you don't understand what the other person is saying, you're at a big disadvantage. You're intimidated. If you understand everything, you can struggle a bit to speak. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, going back to that thing about saying don't feel timid about speaking another language, because I mean mm-hmm. no one owns language, do they? I mean, there's no intellectual property yeah. rights on language as far as I know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's totally open source. So people learning English is yours.
Oh yeah.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Language learning metaphors. It can be difficult to talk about language learning. It becomes a bit sort of metaphysical or something, doesn't it? So metaphors are quite useful. Do you have any favorite metaphors or analogies for learning a language?
For me, of course, it's a voyage of discovery. Because, so my situation is different. Many people learning English, they need English. They need English for their job or because they are immigrants, or they're planning to emigrate, or they're planning to go work in London or New York, or they want to go to university. So it becomes a necessity. Mm. So that puts pressure on them. For me, it's just a voyage of discovery. But I think also, when you speak another language, it's a bit of a game. You're imitating. It's almost like you're play acting.
Yeah.
There's a bit of an unreal there. Real is my own language. When I'm speaking some other language, I'm play acting. I'm pretending to be, French, Chinese, Japanese.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun that way. But that's my dilettante approach. But when you're in serious situations, when I lived in Japan, I did business in Japanese. Everything was in Japanese. It wasn't a game. We were talking business.
Yeah.
But still, I have a sort of a lighthearted approach to it. I don't worry. And I should point out, too, we were talking about people being afraid to make mistakes. I have done business with so many people, either in English or in their language. But when we speak English, it doesn't matter. Like Swedes who speak English very well, they still make mistakes. Germans who speak English quite well, they make mistakes that reflect, structures in their own language. And that's very hard to get rid of. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't impede communication, nor does an accent impede communication. I think very often the sort of accent thing becomes a bit of a vanity project. I'm going to speak with so little accent that no one can tell. We can always tell. Very rarely you find a non-native speaker who learned the language as an adult who can be, completely mistaken for a native. Unlikely to happen.
And why would you want to do that anyway? Unless only a spy really would want to do that, right?
Well, you want to, obviously the pronunciation goal is the native speaker. At some level, whether it be someone from Scotland or Britain or Australia, it doesn't matter. Scotland isn't Britain, but you know what I mean.
At the moment, Steve.
But that's the model that you're trying to imitate. So it's normal. I'm trying to imitate. So the closer I get, the better it is. Of course. Mm. Yes, you want to. So there's the sort of ideal goal is to sound like the native. It's like, ideally, I play golf. I would like to hit the ball like Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
But I'm never going to do that, and that doesn't prevent me from enjoying golf. So my ideal is to speak like, say, a native in French or Japanese or Persian. I'm not going to do that, but it doesn't prevent me. I can have that as a goal and yet be perfectly satisfied with achieving much less than that goal.
Yeah, aim for the stars, hit the moon.
Right.
Kind of thing. Right. You still hit the moon. Right. It's not bad.
Right. It doesn't mean you're falling flat on your face. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Okay, so learning language is it's a voyage of discovery. I've heard you mention before that, I wonder if you remember this, that learning English or learning a language is like mowing your lawn. In your garden.
Oh, yes. I use that because many people feel that they have to absolutely master something.
Mm-hmm.
So if they go into a lesson, they do a lesson, I got to master everything in this lesson. I'm going to master the basics. And it's just not realistic. If I do a lesson or if I listen to something, I'm going to understand it 60%, 70%. And then I'll move on. And I'll go back again later on and I'll pick up what I missed. So in a sense, I was just thinking of that because I was mowing my lawn and I let it grow a bit long. So I adjusted my lawnmower so it wasn't cutting quite as close to the ground, right? So then I can push the lawnmower. It's easier to push the lawnmower. Mm-hmm. I go one pass at that higher level. Then I go back in and adjust the lawnmower down. And then I pick up the rest of the lawn, right?
Yeah.
So by having had two pass, three passes going... skimming it the first time, getting a little deeper the second time, that's fine. You don't have to master stuff when you first go at it. Make it easy for yourself.
So a nice short, a lawn with short grass is the goal. Like you want your lawn to be you want the grass to be cut so it's all neat and short. But since you've left it quite long, because you've been in Palm Springs, right, and you haven't been mowing the lawn in Vancouver, you've let it grow quite long. But you can't get that goal with the first in one go.
It's too hard.
The machine won't do it. It'll clog up the machine and you'll fail. So you have to just kind of, as you say, skim the very top of the grass and then come back and do another pass and do it again and again and again. It's like the mountain metaphor. You can't climb it in one single step. You can't eat you wouldn't eat a pizza in one single go. How do you eat an elephant? No. You eat it one spoon at a time. How do you mow your lawn after you've left it for ages? You skim it and then you skim it again and you keep skimming it until you get to the desired
exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And I might add that, you know, we have these mini stories at length, which are basic. That's where we begin.
Yeah.
Yet, I can always go back to the mini stories, and I will always notice something that I hadn't noticed before. A word that I still hadn't remembered, or a structure. We can always go back and find things that we hadn't noticed before. So we're not going to pick it up, all of it, the first time. So we can always go back and notice different things if we're paying attention.
Mm. Repetition. I don't know how many.
Repetition and novelty. That's the other thing that I say. You know, this, I quote Manfred Spitzer, who is a German neuroscientist, who says that the brain requires repetition, but also novelty.
You can't keep on
feeding the brain novelty.
Yeah.
New stuff. The brain wants new stuff. You can't just feed it repetition. You've got to give it novelty. And this gets back to this whole idea of interleaving. You can't give the person, you know, here's this list of words, learn them. By the third time you're going over the list of words, you're not learning anything. You have to move on and come back. This interleaving, go and study it over there and then come back here and then maybe hit the same basic vocabulary or same type of content in some other context, and then you come back again. So it's sort of a grazing type of process. It's more effective than the sort of block learning. You can't just pump stuff into the brain, repetition, repetition, repetition. There has to be a mixture. We need repetition, but we need novelty.
So we're like cows, really, in the way that cows eat grass.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, there's another one. Learning a language is like a cow eating grass because?
Right. Because you got to keep moving. If you stay in the same sort of part of the field, all the grass will be gone. You got to move to some other areas and eat some grass. In the meantime, that area will have grown some more grass.
And also, isn't it true that cows have got several stomachs? So a cow will take loads of grass, chew it for a while, swallow it, sort of digest that for a bit, and then they'll bring it back and swallow it a bit and chew it a bit more, right?
That's a very good metaphor. I like it. I like it.
It's a little disgusting, but I guess it works.
Yeah, yeah. That's how it works.
Yeah. So there you go. Chew on the language, swallow it, leave it, let your stomach try and digest it, bring it back up, chew on the...
It is amazing how sometimes you'll be reading something in a language you're learning and you come across some vocabulary which will trigger the memory of some other vocabulary that you'd, you know, put into your memory reserve long ago, and all of a sudden it comes up.
Mm.
And you can't control that, but those things do happen.
Yeah, okay. Another one for you. I've heard you say that learning a language is like cross-country skiing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember saying that?
Well, I have done a lot of listening to... Well, it is in two ways, really. Number one, because when you're cross-country skiing, very often, you know, you're on a plateau. So you're just going.
Mm-hmm.
So you may as well enjoy it. The scenery, like when I go cross-country skiing, I'm going through the forest or whatever, and I'm enjoying the scenery. But the other thing about cross-country skiing, it's just like jogging, it's a great opportunity to listen. So I have gone through the forest listening to Russian novels and cross-country skiing, and I'm out in the cold, and it's a beautiful day. And so it's a great language learning environment. I think if we can learn while we're active, I think there's some evidence that that's good, that the brain is kind of, chemicals are running around in the brain that help you learn. So being active and learning is good.
There's probably people listening to this right now in the gym or running somewhere.
If that's no doubt.
Go for it. Good. Keep it up, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just going to ask you actually about your experiences. So, I mean, you know, you've sort of had many different lives, sort of thing. Like, I understand that. So, you first came to Europe in when you were a teenager. Is that right? So, you grew up in Canada, and then at some point you came over to England and then France.
Right.
What happened?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was working on construction in the summer, and I decided I wanted to go over to Europe. So I went down to the Port of Montreal, and for you couldn't do this today, but for three consecutive days, I went to these ships that were in the port, and I said, I'd like to speak to the captain. And they said, fine. Today, there'd be a metal detector or something, you know, and I said, I want to work my way across to Europe. And so on the third day, there was a German vessel, and the captain said, sure, we lost a sailor, went overboard in Quebec City, so you can come on.
Wow, really? Well, they had a space because one of the sailors had gone overboard and hadn't survived?
Yeah, he took off. Yeah. Not gone overboard. Like, he just left.
He just left. Oh, okay. I thought you mean he died. And
No, they didn't throw him overboard. Oh, no, I shouldn't have said gone overboard. He left them. He
went
away. So,
yeah.
AWOL.
Yeah.
So I spent 10 days, you know, pounding on rusty metal and scraping metal and painting. That's all there ever was to do on the ship.
Yeah.
But then I hitchhiked around Europe and I ended up in France and studied there for 3 years.
You already spoke French when you arrived, did you?
Oh, yeah. Because I had my sort of moment of discovering French when I was at McGill University, and I had this professor who made it all very interesting for me. So therefore, I was motivated to go. I wanted to go to France and study in France because I became so, you know, interested in French.
Okay. And you studied at Sciences Po, the university?
Yeah. The first year I was at Grenoble, and then I started studying political science there. I don't really know for what reason. And then I transferred to Sciences Po. I got a scholarship from the French government. So first year in Grenoble, I had about three jobs selling newspapers on the, you know, in the cafes on the main square and teaching English and all kinds of stuff. And then I got to Paris and I had a scholarship. So things were improved.
Right. So your French was at a decent enough level to be able to study political science at university. Okay. And then, so then you ended up, you were a diplomat, but you also spent time selling Canadian lumber, like wood and stuff, right?
Right. So first of all, I was accepted into the Canadian Diplomatic Service, largely, I think, because I wrote the Foreign Service exam as an Anglophone in French. So that improved my odds of being accepted, right? There weren't that many Anglophones who would have written that exam in French. And then I heard that the government wanted to train people in Chinese. So actually, I started taking Chinese lessons in Ottawa. And then I went to the director of the Trade Commission Service and said, look, I hear you're going to send someone to learn Chinese. I'm your man because I've already started doing it. Why wouldn't they choose me? I've already shown an interest in learning the language.
Yeah.
So then I was sent to Hong Kong to learn Chinese. Thereafter, I ended up in Japan, Tokyo, at the Canadian Embassy. And then I was looking after forest products within, you know, in the commercial section of the embassy. And then a company out of Vancouver was looking to set up their own office in Tokyo. And so then they recruited me and made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So I said, okay.
Okay, so you were there in Tokyo essentially selling Canadian wood to the Japanese. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a big market. It was a big market. So I set up an office for this Canadian exporting company, and we had, and we were selling lumber. And I did that for one company, went back to Vancouver, and then I was recruited by their main competitor to go out to Tokyo and do the same thing again, both lumber and pulp and paper products. Again, to Asia, like main market being Japan, but also the other markets of Asia.
Okay. How, what was your...
And then in 1987, I set up my own company in forest products, exporting to Japan.
Okay. All right. What kind of forest products? Just big lumps of wood?
Well, I mean, it's typically, lumber. It's sawn lumber. And particularly with my own company, we were making, kiln-dried and planed the components of different sizes to suit the specific needs of the Japanese market.
Okay. What was your experience in Japan? That was the 80s?
So I lived in Japan basically much of the 70s, like 71 to 77, then 80 to 82.
Yeah.
And then I was traveling to and from Japan throughout the 80s. And then when I started my own company, 87, that continued. You know, 3-4 times a year, I'd be flying off to Japan to meet with our customers. My experience was, it was wonderful. Japan has a wonderful wood culture. Mm-hmm. The way they appreciate wood was very interesting to me. Once you speak Japanese and you can deal with the downstream people, it was wonderful. They were very, you know,
accommodating,
welcoming, yeah, and accommodating. And they, you know, you have to, all you have to do is you have to, I mean, it's a very demanding market. You have to, give them what they want and, understand, you have to understand what they want. And, you know, we were shipping lumber to Japan. We were shipping containers with 30,000 pieces in the container. You know, 22 millimeter by 57 millimeter by 1 meter long, 1.3 meter. And they had to be, the knot size had to be just so. And we had to measure, you know, take samples every so often and send them graphs of the upper control limit, lower control limit of knot size and twist. And so, I mean, it's very, very demanding.
Yeah.
And inevitably you have problems, quality problems, and then you have to, I apologize, and I will get the whole plant floor together and we'll talk about this and we'll fix it. And you have to demonstrate the sort of commitment. I mean, it's serious.
Yeah.
But at the same time, then there are moments, you play golf with your customers, or they take you out for dinner. And so it was a wonderful experience all around, and very educational.
I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, I lived in Japan for 2 years, but I mean, that was, you know, 2002, 2003. But in the 70s, I guess it must have been fairly uncommon for a lot of Japanese people to see a Westerner.
Yeah, it wasn't that uncommon, but I would say that if I compare Japan in the 70s to now, they were more conscious of the fact that you were a foreigner. So some of them didn't like you. Other people gave you special treatment, but you were always different.
Yeah.
Whereas now, that's not so much the case. You're just person A, and he or she is person B. And there's less of that sense of us and them, which was more there. But they were still overwhelmingly nice to me, I can say, overwhelmingly. Pleasant experience. Sometimes I made them feel uncomfortable. They didn't know how to deal with a foreigner, kind of thing. But that became less and less the situation. And I find now you have Japanese people all over the world doing all kinds of different things. Japan has opened up a lot since the 70s.
Absolutely. Okay. So going back to the fact that you're learning Arabic and Persian at the moment, and so you're reading a lot of content in those languages about so you like to read sort of non-fiction or historical accounts and things, don't you? You like to read the history of Persia. Yes. And so on.
Right. Now, realistically, in Arabic, I can't do that very well. Arabic is very difficult because you have sort of standard Arabic, which is almost, it's not the language that people speak to each other. So then you have to get at least a smattering of Egyptian Arabic and Levantine Arabic so that you can at least have a chance of understanding the movies and stuff like that. Mm. So Arabic is a long road. Like, I'll never get to be very good in Arabic. Persian, at least it's one language, one country. And I have this person who has given Link so much content in Persian, including on the history of Iran. But a lot of it, too, it triggers an interest, right? So I go through her material on the history of Iran, which is a little easier. But then I'll read in English about Iran. So through the language, even if I'm not reading about the history of Iran in Persian, it's triggering an interest in Persian history, as is the case with Arabic and Turkish, for that matter. I just get interested in the area, so I read it in English as well.
Yeah.
On the history and the culture.
Yeah, I see. Have you learned anything interesting then about those places?
Well, I think what's really interesting is to follow the development of Islam and the expansion then of Islam and the Arabs out of Saudi Arabia into, you know, the Middle East and eventually into Iran, and the extent to which the Persians were so influential, first of all, within the, Islamic State, you know, the Abbas, particularly under I think the first group was the Umayyads, and the next group were the Abbasids or something, but very much influenced by Persians. And in particular, sort of eastern Iran, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, the area around Central Asia was a major center of civilization and learning and mathematics and science and philosophy 1,000 years ago. I never knew that.
Mm.
And those people were particularly influential in the development of the whole Middle East and stuff. So you learn a whole bunch of stuff. And of course, pretty violent history, I guess. And you got the Ottoman Empire and the Arabs and the Persians. And then, of course, India, which was very much influenced by at least the Persian language, because the Mughal Empire, those were essentially Turkic. And then, you learn about the sort of interaction between the Turks and the Persian speakers and the Turkic language speakers. And it's just fascinating.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's absolutely never ending. Mm-hmm. And when you then use the language, you know, when you actually speak the language, you know, you sort of start to get a taste of, you somehow enter the world of it all, don't
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. And in Vancouver, we have a lot of immigrants from Iran. So every chance I get, I use the language. And of course, I get a very positive response. I think the Iranians are amongst the most appreciative when you speak their language. And I have a sense of Iran of 2,500 years of history that I never had before. We think of Iran today, we think of the mullahs, and we think of women all dressed in black and the horrible suppression of the demonstrators. And it's a lot of negative stuff.
Mm.
But I realize there's 2,500 years of history there, interaction with India, with Greece, with Central Asia, with China. I've watched some Iranian movies. They have very good movies. It's, in many ways, the sense of a country with this tremendous ancient history, but yet very modern in a way. Iran is more Western than the Arabic countries, I think. Certainly than Egypt. You know, less sort of hidebound religious and stuff, and quite modern in many ways.
Yes. And have you noticed any similarities between Persian and English? Is there some words are similar? No.
Well, I mean, there's words like Bechtar is better. Okay, sounds kind of similar, but there's no relationship. There's 15% common vocabulary between Persian and Arabic, and also between Persian and Turkish. But the structure of the language is very much European,
right?
Unlike Arabic. The structure is...
It's an Indo-European language, isn't it?
Indo-European language, very, very similar structure. But it has its own thing, you know. Like, for example, much is made now in the Western world about gender-neutral pronouns, which to my mind is a silly thing. But in Persian and Arabic, they only have, not Arabic, but Persian and Turkish, they only have gender-neutral pronouns. There is no he, she, it. It's just ooh.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily mean that they're, you know, that they're more
progressive in terms of gender neutrality and stuff.
Progressive, right? That's meaningless.
But that's quite convenient, though, isn't it, to not have to worry about
very
the genders? Because I mean, example, with French, I mean, that's a bit of a nightmare.
Exactly. Arabic has gender, but Persian doesn't have gender. Persian has many things. If Persian were written in the Latin alphabet, it would be quite easy to learn. Other than the fact that there's not a lot of common vocabulary. Like, obviously, when an English-speaking person learns French or vice versa, they have a lot of freebie vocabulary.
Yeah.
Not the case with Persian. But leaving that aside, in terms of the structure of the language, it's the writing system that's the biggest obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not an obstacle. That's what it is, period. But.
Yeah, challenge, maybe, if we want to put it in more positive terms.
Right.
What do you have any plans to have a go at any other languages?
Maybe. You know, you can, at some point, you know, it's so hard. You keep adding languages, and then that means the languages you learned before, you no longer speak them very well. So at some point, you know. But I am kind of curious about the structure of South Asian languages. So it might be Hindi, or we have a lot of Punjabi speakers in Vancouver. If we get one of those languages at Link, we have Gujarati, but I'm not very motivated to learn Gujarati. The inconvenience with the Indian languages is that they all have their own writing system, sort of.
Hmm.
So at least if they all had the same writing system, then it wouldn't matter almost which one you learn, because there's some of the northern Indian languages, leaving the southern Indian languages aside. So I might do that. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
Okay.
No immediate plans.
All right.
Currently, I'm enjoying bumbling along in Persian and Arabic.
Okay. Well, hey, it's really fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
I enjoyed it. Okay.
And, right. Do you want to do a bit of shameless self-promotion at the end?
Well, it's just that I enjoy language learning. I have a YouTube video, at least a channel called Lingo Steve. So you're welcome to come and watch my videos there. Subscribe if you want. I have this language learning platform, which I co-founded with my son Mark, called LingQ.com, which is where I learn languages. And I think it fills a need. It's part of the whole picture. I think anyone learning languages is going to want to do a variety of different things. Maybe take lessons, maybe buy some books, maybe travel to the country. And I think Link kind of is quite complimentary, fits in there.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, Steve Kaufman, thank you very much. And have a lovely day.
I enjoyed it, Luke.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye for now. So there you go. Learning a language is a voyage of discovery, which is a nice way of thinking about it, isn't it? It's like a voyage of discovery. That's wonderful. That's a lovely, pleasant image. You can imagine yourself maybe on some romantic-looking ship or something. Not the Titanic. Not the Titanic. That wasn't a voyage of discovery, the Titanic. That was more like an arrogant vanity project almost, wasn't it? That was like humans going, we've built a ship that's unsinkable. No, I'm not talking about that kind of thing, which, you know, that sort of overconfidence, the overconfidence of the Titanic, where you say this ship is unsinkable and then it promptly sinks. No, it's a more realistic approach, and it's a voyage of discovery. So you can imagine yourself taking a leisurely boat ride down some lovely river or something like that. I don't know, but it's a voyage of discovery. That is a nice way of putting it. Or that learning a language is like cross-country skiing. Right, a lot of the time you are on a plateau. So cross-country skiing, that's where you are skiing across country. That's not downhill skiing, okay? Cross-country skiing is the arguably slightly more boring version of skiing. All right, now I don't mean to sort of have a go at cross-country skiers. It does look nice. But cross-country skiing is the one where people kind of push themselves along. They're not just going down a hill. They push themselves along. There are two narrow little tracks in the snow, and they use these narrow skis, which seem to not be attached properly at the ankle, at the heel, but that allows people to kind of push through the snow, and people kind of go on cross-country skiing expeditions through the forest. So learning a language is like cross-country skiing, because I think it should be a pleasant thing to do, but also, as Steve said, often you're on a plateau. You might not be constantly climbing, or it doesn't have perhaps the exhilarating adrenaline rush of downhill skiing where everything's moving very fast and you're going very quickly. That's not the way it works with language learning. You go slowly. You might be on a plateau for quite a long time, or maybe it feels like a flat surface, but actually you're slowly climbing as you go up a hill or something. And then later on, you can kind of slide down the hill. But it's not quite as dramatic as downhill skiing. And so you take time to enjoy it, to look around and appreciate your surroundings. So if you're learning language, you take plenty of time. You enjoy the process, even though it might feel like you're sort of on one level. You might not realize that you're going up and up and up slowly. And maybe you feel it's a bit tiring because you do have to push yourself forward all the time. So it's kind of like cross-country skiing. What else? Learning a language is like being a cow. So you eat the grass, so you consume the English, and you chew. You kind of do your best to digest what you've consumed, and you swallow it, and it goes down into one of your stomachs. So this is if you're a cow. And the stomach works on the grass, or your brain somehow works on the language. Okay, but that's not it. That's not the end of the process. You might have to, get that grass back again and bring it back into your mouth and give it another chew, work on it a bit more and swallow it again. And then it moves from this stomach to this stomach. So, you know, you are constantly working on the same things again and again. It's not just one gulp, gone. I mean, you're not a crocodile. I've said that learning a language is like being a shark in the sense that you have to always be moving. There's another reason why it's like cross-country skiing. You always have to be moving. If you stop moving when you're cross-country skiing, it's kind of hard to get the momentum going again. So it's the same with language learning. You basically have to be a shark on skis. Okay? Just always moving all the time. Not a crocodile. Crocodiles eat things in one go. Like, hum, zebra, bang. Take a big chunk out of a zebra and then hum, swallow it in one go. No, it doesn't work like that. You have to be like a cow. Yum, yum, yum. Very slowly. Eat some grass here. Chew it. Digest it. Have another chew of the same grass. Digest it again. Move to another piece of grass. Enjoy the fresh air. You know, I'm sure there were other analogies and metaphors, weren't there? Were there? There were, I'm sure. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Steve Kaufman there from Canada, the extraordinary language learner. Obviously, you can draw your own conclusions about language learning from that conversation. And, you know, like Steve has been criticized before by some people. People who say, well, his approach is a bit vague, and people might say that it doesn't, that some learners need more structure than that. And if you're a very busy person, taking Steve's leisurely approach might not work for you. Okay, but what we do know is that everyone is different, right? So what works for Steve might not work for you, but I think at its core, I think it's true, right? That if you can spend time with the language, that it's going to pay off, that it is practice plus time multiplied by motivation. Practice and time, okay? And, you know, you've got to just find out what works for you and do that. Like for me, for example, I've found that graphic novels are a great way to get French into me. It's a great way for me to eat French, as it were. You know, I've tried lots of things with French and a lot of them just don't seem to click, but graphic novels, that's working for me. So that's great. Also, another conclusion that I take from this, which is also something I've said before many times, it's quite encouraging talking to someone like Steve, who has so much experience of learning languages. And his conclusions are very similar to the conclusions that I've had. So, you know, find out what works for you. Relax a bit and don't beat yourself up if you are not making perfect progress. Don't beat yourself up if you're making mistakes. Don't beat yourself up. You know what beat yourself up means? That's like, you know, like to sort of abuse yourself. Not abuse yourself. No, that's not the right expression. To fight with yourself. Why aren't you better? Smack. You should. Oh, you made a mistake. You made a stupid mistake. Whack. Don't beat yourself up. Okay. Relax. And don't be too hard on yourself. Mistakes are all part of the process. Of course we're going to make mistakes. Of course we're going to get it wrong and all that sort of thing. I mean, it's just normal, isn't it? Yeah, it is. Enjoy it. Try to enjoy the process. Be interested in everything. Be interested in not just the language, but in everything else. So, for example, Steve is interested in the history of the country where that language comes from. Okay, he's looking beyond, he's going beyond just the language and looking into the history of the country, and by being interested in that, that allows him to read a lot in his target language. Don't rush it, give it time. So yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm a teacher who does some language learning. He's a learner, a language learner who does some language teaching. And it's interesting that his conclusions kind of mirror my own and also gives me further encouragement for this whole podcast project, you know, that I must be doing something right. So that's good. It made me feel good talking to Steve and at the end, after I'd pressed, you know, stop on the record button, Steve was saying, oh yeah, podcasts are brilliant. I really think you're doing the right thing. This is a great thing for language learning. So keep it up. He was very enthusiastic and very encouraging, which I appreciate very much. So just in case you were in any doubt about the value of listening to Luke's English podcast, there it is. I mean, Steve Kaufman has confirmed it as well. So there you are. Listen to my show. I mean, you know this already, of course. I don't need to say this because you are one of those people who listens all the way through to the end. But good. Good for you. That's great. Well done. Nice one. Give yourself a nice slap on the back for that. Good job. Well done. Well done. Well done. Okay. And yeah, keep listening. Even if you don't understand stuff. Like, how was that for you? Did you follow everything that Steve Kaufman said? That the sound might have made a slight difference. I think his voice was clear. I understood everything he said, but he was sitting in a room with a microphone on the desk, and he wasn't sitting in a soundproofed room, so there was a bit of reverb on his side that might have made it a little bit harder to understand him. But I don't know. You can tell me. But in any case, even if you don't understand everything, that's okay. You keep going, right? Even if you feel like you got a bit lost, that's all right. You just keep going, okay? You've got to be like a shark. Keep moving all the time. You're a shark on skis, okay? Right, you're a cross between a cow and a shark on skis. Like, a cow and a shark had a baby, and they put skis on it and then made it ski across Norway. That's you, okay? All right. Thank you again to Steve Kaufman for his contribution to this episode. Thank you to you for listening and for being a wonderful listener who listens all the way through to the end. I think that the dividends that you get speak for themselves, right? You're getting more English into your brain, and you've got to keep feeding yourself English. And good. I hope that I help you to do that. I hope you enjoy these English cakes that I prepare for you. You are the child of a shark and a cow on skis, skiing along, eating cake. Right? Okay. I think that's probably where we'll end this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I will speak to you again soon. But for now, it's time to say goodbye. Bye. 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 Thanks for listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right, because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.